Welcome to Business Talk with Megan McNulty, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of business success and reveals the strategies, insights, and stories that drive these professionals to thrive in the ever-evolving world of business. Whether you're an established entrepreneur, a seasoned business owner, or simply fascinated by the world of commerce, this podcast is your front row seat to learn from the best. Each episode, Megan will bring you engaging interviews with professionals from diverse industries who will share their triumphs, lessons learned, and the insights they've gained along the way. Hi, Brandon. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Megan. How are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us. So we wanted to talk about Freedom Research Foundation, which is your 501c3. And I'm just curious, can you tell us a little bit about what Freedom Research Foundation is?
Absolutely. First of all, thank you so much for having me. And I really appreciate an opportunity to speak to your listeners, and hopefully they'll, at the very least, if they disagree with everything that I have to say, maybe it'll be thought-provoking and they can continue to look into what we do. So Freedom Research Foundation, as you said, is a 501c3 nonprofit foundation, research and education foundation. So our responsibility is to try to educate Americans, both in the private and public sector, on what's going on in the world and how do we make better decisions, as I said, both in the private and public sector, to preserve the freedom fundamentally, but also the way of life that I think is integral to what it means to be American. And so we research on the ground, looking at the historical, anthropological, political, geopolitical realities happening in different parts of the world. We make assessments, and then we determine what are the specific things that we can do. And sometimes that's going and briefing people at a country club, or meeting with congressmen in their office, or providing reports that we deliver to people who are actively in the military working in that theater. And all of it is to try to expand the amount of freedom that exists within that area that we're engaged in researching.
Amazing. So you talk a lot about American values and the research you're doing. I'm just curious, what does it mean to be American from your point of view?
I really like this question because I fundamentally believe that it's not a matter of opinion. It's a matter of historical fact and cultural reality. So, you know, America as a country is really the only place in the world where it does not matter what your ethnic group is, what your religion is, even necessarily on some level, some of your personal beliefs. But what does matter is that you inherently believe that every individual has a sovereignty over their freedoms as a person, and that to be American means that we're accepting that social contract between each other, fellow Americans, and between our government, that fundamentally the most important thing are individual rights and freedoms, and that your freedom should be preserved not only culturally amongst yourselves, but also by your government, and that should come first. And, you know, I think what is really important about this historically is you look at, you know, the people that first came to North America and started kind of the historical process of building the governance that we have today. They were running from religious persecution. And so religious freedom is an integral part of the American identity, but also all the freedoms, right? Freedom of press, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, and of course, a free market economy, because you need to be able to prosper as an individual. And I think that as you explore the world and you see different cultures and different people, no matter where I go in the world, I've been to 110 countries over 35 years, and I will always find people who think just like, you know, most Americans do about how they want to live their lives, that willingness and idea of being able to express themselves and to be free. And I think that's what draws people to America. You know, that's why almost everywhere I go, you know, without fail, and I say that I'm American, a smile goes on their face. And it's because America is a place that people aspire to visit, aspire to be like, aspire to learn about. And I think it's a huge responsibility. I don't think America is living up to that responsibility, and we can talk about that a little bit in the future. But it's an immense privilege. And I'll be honest, this is going to be controversial to some of your listeners, but my experience is some of the best Americans are the ones who came from somewhere else. And they weren't necessarily born in America, they were naturalized, but they sir lived in a place where their way of life was persecuted, or they were being oppressed by a government, whether it be communism or some kind of other ideology. And they come to America and they finally have that ability to express themselves as individuals, and they love America, and they are sometimes the most patriotic people. I think sometimes those of us, like myself, who was born in America, we take it for granted, and we don't realize what it really means to be persecuted in a place like Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq or Libya, to use some examples.
Right. I totally agree. I just recently listened to a podcast that talked about how Americans are really used to peace and safety and security. And now we have a war in Ukraine and Russia, and then the war in Gaza, that is kind of being questioned now, how safe really is America and our security that we've had over the last couple of years. So how do you think Americans preserve their way of life?
This is also a fantastic question. And both of these are things that I think in American society today, we need to take a harder look at, because I think what it means to be an American and how do you preserve that way of life are questions we're not asking ourselves. But to answer your question, and it's interesting because I once wrote this piece and gave a talk called The Three P's of Freedom: the protection of freedom, the preservation of freedom, and the participation of freedom. And I think these are integral parts of the cultural identity of America, which is that, I wouldn't have fought for name the fascist government in the last 50 years, the Soviet Union or Germany in World War II. I wouldn't have fought for any of these places. Why? Because I did not believe in the ideas that they were trying to perpetrate. They were trying to oppress, kill, and hurt human beings. But I was willing to join the military and to defend my country because I believed in the ideas that Americans embody. But without Americans who every day wake up and have jobs and, treat their kids with respect and teach them, educate them, and tell them to treat people of all kinds with dignity and respect as human beings first, without having political discourse and saying, hey, we can disagree, but we can still treat each other with dignity and respect and not become violent or, become nasty, challenge each other intellectually and logically on, some of these debates that we're having in American society today. But it's this behavior and this culture of what it means to be American, subscribing and holding our government accountable to its responsibility to us. This government in America works for the American people, not the other way around. The government, bureaucrats have forgotten that. Our politicians have forgotten that. And you can sense this frustration amongst all Americans, I believe, in this kind of lack of trust or confidence in the social contract between the people and the government. And that creates unrest. And we've seen it in the past couple of years of people hitting the streets, regardless of their ideology. They've lost confidence in the responsibilities that the government has to preserving our individual freedom. And that shows itself when people start taking actions into their own hands. So, preserving the American way of life means treating people with dignity and respect and adhering to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, our individual rights to express our freedom, but not at the detriment to another American. And the best way to do that at home is to live our lives every single day and to be productive members of our society, as I said, and engage in politics, engage in political discourse. And it's interesting because I'll meet a lot of people and they say, oh, I'm not political. But I've never met a person who didn't have an opinion about something. And
Right.
if you have an opinion about women's rights or, economics or whatever it is, then you have an interest in American politics and you need to be engaged. That's how we preserve it at home. And when I mentioned the protection, there any of us who served our country, There's nothing worth defending if Americans every day aren't doing that. So that has to come first. It's only then is it worth it for us to sacrifice defending our country. And of course, lastly, the participation, which means if we're doing all of this working and, being Americans and, protecting the American culture, and then we're going and defending it, but we're not having a good time and we're not doing the barbecues and the parties and enjoying life, then what's the point, right? So you got to participate in freedom. You got to enjoy it as well.
Good point. So let's switch to basically, so you're running a 501c3, which is Freedom Research Foundation, and you're raising money for this organization so you can go out and do this research on conflict zones. Can you kind of explain what inspired you to start this nonprofit or and focus on researching cultures and conflict zones?
Yeah, I think it's important to provide a little bit of history, and that the organization was actually started by my father in 1984.
Okay.
I reinvigorated it after I left the Marine Corps in 2015. But the history of the organization I think is really important because it really illustrates that we have the same problem today in America that we had in the 1980s when my father started the organization, but for a very different reason. And so the story is basically that my father grew up in Hollywood, California. My grandfather was the first late night TV show host. It's called Jackson's Theater. And so in 1966, my father was a senior at UCLA, and he read an article written by a B-rate actor nobody had ever heard of, said he was going to run for governor. So my father went to my grandfather's study and said, "Do you know this actor, Ronald Reagan?" He said, "Sure, I know Ronnie. We were in radio together." So my father became chairman of Youth Reagan and Governor Reagan's campaign in 1966 and developed a personal relationship with the president. But my father was never a government type of person. He was never the kind of person who was going to work, in the government. But he had an amazing experience, undergraduate in anthropology, PhD in philosophy and Aristotelian ethics. And he had spent times with indigenous population. I mean, we're talking about in like the 50s and the 60s, living with people who, actually were cannibals and ate other humans in the Amazon jungle, wanting to
Okay.
just understand and learn these cultures, right? And so he had this immense understanding of how critical and important culture was fundamentally into understanding the realities in a conflict of what was going on. So in the 80s, he wanted to make his contribution to how he could help support, defend America, and preserve our way of life. And he thought the best way to do that was to travel to places where communism was expanding and the Soviet Union was on the ground. And going and finding people who were fighting freedom, and then coming back and briefing people in the White House and other government agencies. And that's really how it started. And so, what was really important at that time is that what we had was kind of a shortage of information. Now we have an immense amount of information, and as we've all heard, disinformation. So, the same problem is that we had not enough information then and too much information now, but we still have a lack of understanding. And it is really important for us at Freedom Research Foundation to try to be as objective and possible as we describe groups, ideas, viewpoints on the ground. And, when what really inspired me to kind of take over this work and leave the military is I saw the consequence of American foreign policy fail over and over again in the fact that, what really represented America and the ideas and the people who put on the uniform to go serve and defend their country were not the ideas that we were exporting to places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and Syria. We were not exporting freedom. We were exporting bureaucracy, we were exporting corruption, and we were exporting dysfunction. And so there was more tyranny that was being, perpetrated as a consequence of this. And it wasn't on purpose. A lot of people in the Middle East, in my experience, always think that we were doing these things on purpose. We weren't. We were doing it with good intentions, but we were culturally unaware of the decisions we were making and the impact it was going to have on the people that we were making them. And so I wanted to try to rectify that, to honor those that I lost in Afghanistan and my fellow Americans. And I also believe, most importantly, that We talked about preserving the American way of life at home, but the way to preserve the American way of life doesn't just stop at the water's edge. By helping people who share fundamental human and I believe universal values, those are integral to the American identity. Finding those people and making them successful is a way to preserve the American way of life, and it's also a way to defeat our enemies. Because somewhere in the world, anywhere in the world, you're going to go, there's going to be people, and those people are going to be making decisions. And whether it's illicit, informal, formal, it's a form of governance, right? A set of rules and laws and norms that people adhere to. And so the more that that governance resembles the American way of life, which I think is fundamentally a human desire to be free, the stronger we're going to be as a nation, not only at home, but also abroad.
Wow, that was powerful. How do you pick which conflict zones you focus your research efforts on?
This is actually very complicated and nuanced, but there have to be a lot of conditions present in order to make a small, organization like ours effective, right? I believe in every country in the world, as I said earlier, there are people, and more than just a few, who want to live their lives just the way we do in America. However, in order for them to be successful, there has to be an opportunity. And usually what that means is some kind of war or conflict or civil unrest. And so what we have to do as an organization, Freedom Research Foundation, is we have to understand, and I use this imagery to give people kind of an idea. We have to understand the history of that place, not only, the history that goes back into how it built kind of the cultural identity today, but the anthropological history, the empires that may have been in that place, the different religions and ideas that have existed there. And so I would call that a, substructure. What's underneath the ground, kind of that history that you're going to try to then build a foundation on. And that foundation is the current political situation, right? That's going to fundamentally determine, whether or not something can be built that's going to let you build that superstructure, that building that you're going to put on top of it. And that's the future, right? That superstructure is the place that you can help set conditions to create a government that really represents individual freedoms and prosperity and economic prosperity. And so to give you an example, and without kind of going too far into this, but I've been speaking a lot in the abstract, and so I can give you a couple of kind of specific examples of what I mean and how this comes to fruition.
Okay, perfect. That'd be great.
So, one of the places that I had some experience previous to my time in the Marine Corps was in Syria. And I think, for people who are interested, they've probably heard about Syria, or they know the name is the Syrian Arab Republic. But what's really important to understand about Syria is that the history there, and that a lot of Syria was part of Christendom. And there's a, the Conference of Nicaea, which really under Constantine kind of created some of the original doctrine of Christianity. There are groups like the Assyrian Eastern Church and the Syriac Orthodox that were participants in this, right? And it was part of the Holy Roman Empire kind of at its end. You had a massive Christian history, but you also had this really powerful ethnic and cultural diversity of the Kurdish population, which is a matriarchal society, which means the predominant member of the immediate family is the woman. And they were originally Zoroastrian, which was the first monotheistic religion that taught good deeds, good words, good thoughts. And so for people who have been to, the parts of the world where we call it Kurdistan, because it's not an actual country, but an ethnic population that sits at the confluence of Syria, Iraq, Turkey, and Iran, you'll see the people behave in a very unique, different way. And sometimes, and most of the times, it's kind of the most organized and in many respects, most functioning place. Why? Because culturally, they have this democratic behavior as a people. And I always say democracy has to be a behavior before it can be a form of government. And so I had this experience. And when, the revolution in 2011 started, I was engaged in the military working in the Libya war. But I knew intuitively that there was this incredible opportunity for a future democratic state in Syria, or even a democratic Syria. And I would say the same thing about Iran, by the way. It's an incredibly multi-ethnic, multi-religious place. We think of it as this, like, single place. You look out on the map and you see lines and you see a capital, it says Tehran or Iran, and we're like, oh, that's just a place. And some people may say it's a bad or good place, but it's a very complex, dynamic, historical, ethnically, religiously, and culturally diverse place, which gives it the opportunity to create a government that is ingrained in individual freedom. And so I immediately went back when I got out of the military in 2015 and started to engage some of the people that I had known previously from some of my work before I joined the Marine Corps. And I realized that the fundamental ideas and vision that the people had certainly aligned with some of the most important ideas in American culture and the American identity. And one of them, I mentioned in the beginning, was religious freedom. The people there believed wholeheartedly that you had your right to believe whatever religion you wanted. And they made extreme efforts to protect the Yazidi people, who are a religious minority but ethnically Kurdish, or the different Christian identities I mentioned earlier, the Syrian, the Syriac churches. And so we found an opportunity to be able to educate people in America about this incredible political experiment that they were trying to realize. And one of the things that we first did was to bring then a commissioner, and now the chairman, and actually she later joined our foundation as the treasurer of the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom, Nadine Maenza, and brought her there in 2019 and educated her and showed her the area. And now she's spent months on the ground and she's become an incredible advocate. And we played an integral role, of course, with her support to educate people at the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom staff in their recommendations to the State Department on what the policy should be for the U.S. in northeastern Syria. So, that's a specific example. Of course, we've done a myriad of things to include, briefing the special operations task force on the ground and working with them to help educate them and, network with them on people that they should be working with, both in the governance but also in the military. We've brought sitting U.S. congressmen, former secretaries of defense, and written a complete report on what and how the U.S. military, U.S. government could realize the first state in what could be a democratic federal Syria, similar to the same idea of America, where you have decentralized governance ingrained in individual freedoms and a social contract. And it's really remarkable. I mean, could change the Middle East forever. 4.5 million people, they lost over 10,000 lives in the fight against ISIS. And anybody who served there will tell you they're the best partner we've ever had in, the last 20 years fighting terrorism.
Wow. Americans are upset about Ukraine and Russia, and also now there's a war in Gaza. I think there's a lot of, information out there about both of these conflicts in the world. I would say Americans are confused. They don't really understand the conflict. So how do you think Americans can better educate themselves?
Yeah, I think you've got to challenge yourself to question whatever is the current narrative that you're hearing right now. And you really have to be critical of your own view and challenge it. I think fundamentally, this is the single biggest problem in American politics today, is that Americans and politicians have totally forgotten their responsibility, but specifically politicians, to the American people, which is that it's not to, make other people live your life the way you want them to, right? The purpose of American politicians and people in government is to preserve our way of life so everybody can live their life the way they want to. That's what freedom is about. And what we find is that American domestic politics is driving our understanding of foreign policy without being critical and understanding who or what are these places, right? So you talk about Ukraine and Russia. I was first in both in 1991 with my father after the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, he was the chief, one of the chief architects, or I think people have attributed him in the press as the chief architect of the Reagan Doctrine, which was the systematic support for insurgencies around the world. And you look at these two countries, and Americans do this all the time, right? They look on them, they look at them as equal entities. Okay, you have two countries, Ukraine and Russia, and then they start from there. But there's a lot more to that story, right? There's a lot more to the cultural history between these two places and the recent political history. Vladimir Putin is the longest serving dictator of Russia since Joseph Stalin. Ukraine has had six revolutions and has had multiple presidents and has been fighting, the Ukrainian people have been fighting to force their government to represent them. And that's why they have revolution after revolution. This is a challenging part of about democracy is in seeking freedom, right? Is that it's messy business. It's not easy. And we're experiencing that in America today. Americans are incredibly unhappy with the state of political affairs domestically. But what's important is, and what you're seeing in Ukraine that you're not seeing in Russia, and there's reasons for this. In Ukraine, you're seeing people challenge the status quo. You're seeing people challenge their government and demanding more from them and doing it in a very productive way. Does that make Ukraine perfect? Of course not. Is America? We should never hold other countries to a higher standard than we hold ourselves. But it's important to understand that Russia is not a country of freedom and prosperity, and it should not be treated as an equal place when it comes to individual freedoms and governance, such as Ukraine is. And it's very hard to explain to people that haven't been to either place, who hear a narrative about Russia or about Ukraine and treat them as equal parts. You know, what's being perpetrated in Russia is absolutely horrific. They're sending ethnic minorities, or Vladimir Putin is sending ethnic minorities to the front lines to fight wars that he has perpetrated by invading a sovereign power out of his own political interest to create a neo-czarist Russia, right? He's not trying to reestablish the Soviet Union. You've heard people say that. It's false. He's not an ideologue. He sees himself as the successor to Nicholas II, the Tsar of Russia. And he wants to reestablish that. And he's doing it in a very different fashion, using economics, using politics, in some cases using force, using paramilitary organizations. That's not what Ukraine's doing. Ukraine's not doing that around the world. They're not trying to subjugate people and threaten nation states and individual minorities. Of course not. What they're trying to do is fight for their own personal sovereignty and defend their territorial boundaries. Very different. But what I would say to your question is don't agree with me and don't take anything I say. All I would challenge you to do is if you have a particular view, try to, you know, try to go against it. You know, try to prove yourself wrong and see what you find out.
Very interesting. And so you talked about, okay, so Freedom Research Foundation did conduct a research project in Syria, and you mentioned that earlier. When you guys did this research project, what do you think the biggest challenge you faced when you were trying to conduct this, project there, and how did you overcome it?
You know, it's the same thing we kind of face everywhere. And I see ourselves really as intellectual translators because without, you know, exception, anywhere we go in the world, the people that we meet with have this view of America, which is completely unrealistic, right? They see America as this immensely wealthy, powerful country. And we are one of the most wealthy, if not the most wealthy country in the world, with one of the most impressive economies in the world. And also, singularly, from a matter of force and capacity, the largest, most capable military that's ever walked the face of the earth. However, we can't assume those two things imply knowledge, right? And so we go to a place, and the local people are like, well, of course, America knows everything that's going on, and they understand in detail all of the realities on the ground. And the first challenge we have, quite honestly, and it takes forever, is to convince them that this is in fact not true. That the American government, and quite frankly, and sadly, the American people are immensely ignorant about what is actually going on in these places, and to some extent, could care less, which is unfortunate because the consequence of this is huge on our way of life, you know, in so many ways. Economically, politically, soon we could be in a world where that blue passport that used to be one of the most sought-after passports in the world, you can't travel places because nation states like Iran, Russia, and China don't want you to go there, and they have more influence in that place. So not only from our freedoms, right, which that would inhibit our freedom as American citizens and our safety, but also from a business perspective. We can't do business in places now because these other nations are not allowing us to. But the first thing is being able to convince people that America doesn't know everything. And the second thing is trying to educate Americans on why they should care about what's happening in the world and how it's going to impact their way of life at home. And if people don't realize that, to a large extent, we look at the massive influx, and I think singularly the most kind of unacceptable domestic folly in today's politics is the way our southern borders not being protected and sealed and closed down. This, all of the unrest and disorder happening in the world pushes people to seek out and to come to a place like America. And I think most people reasonably are like, hey, if you're a productive person and you're going to be a great citizen, you can come legally. Why not? But when you don't make that a condition and the world is in complete disorder, then you're basically allowing or setting conditions for people to try to go somewhere else. And so they come here, and unfortunately, that can have detrimental second and third order effects to our way of life at home.
Yes, very much so. So you guys go into this area. Let's just say you're in Syria, right? So your biggest challenge is what you just described with, letting them know that yes, Americans just don't know about you and necessarily in your history and all that. Going into these areas is dangerous. How do you, the people working for Freedom Research Foundation, how do they, ensure their safety in these volatile environments? Or can you comment on that?
Absolutely. I get asked this question a lot, and it's really interesting because, I grew up at a very young age. I was 5 years old when I made my first international trip and spent time with indigenous people in, remote parts of the world. And once again, it kind of goes back to what I said from the beginning is, people around the world, and my father used to say this, if you really want to understand things about human beings, anywhere you go in the world, child laughter is the same, and I think that when you see and you meet people from different cultures around the world, you start to appreciate the fact that you can really get a sense of who people are just by spending time with them and learning from them and listening to them. And so the single biggest strength we have is being able to understand the nuances of the culture, the groups, the people in a particular place. And surrounding ourselves around people who actually care more about our lives than we do, in the sense that there aren't a lot of us. There are not a lot of people going to these places trying to find those who want to live a freer, better, more well-governed life. And so they want to make sure that we're safe. And so they do everything that they can to do that. And most of the people that work for us, certainly alongside, have served their country in some capacity. And so they have experience in these places. But what I've realized more than anything else, what's more important than anything, is really understanding culture and understanding people. And that will keep you safe. I hope that answered the
Okay.
question.
No, that's it. I think that was a really thoughtful, interesting answer. And then I guess my next question is a lot of Americans will give Freedom Research Foundation, donations to for you guys to go out and do your work. When you guys complete this work, such as I know you had a project in Ukraine and one in Syria. When you've completed this research in places like those two countries, what are you hoping policymakers, humanitarian organizations, or the general public will get out of your research?
First, I really think that Americans, should see the value, not only personally, individually, but also culturally, to try to understand the world more and try to understand its complexity and its nuance. We are an incredible people and culture. People see us as very generous and kind. I always hear, no matter where I go in the world, how, oh, I've been to America, or I've been to this place or that place in the United States, and sometimes some obscure town I've never heard of in, Wyoming. But I almost without question hear how wonderful and kind and generous the American people are. And I think that it's important that Americans, go out into the world and see that. And so, when we identify our research and we tell Americans, like I said, whether it be at a corporate, speech or corporate lunch or at a golf club, or, you hosted me and one of our senior advisors, Chris Miller, at a function in Newport. What we hope is that we show them that there is hope in the world. And, I fully agree with the discontent that Americans have about the way American foreign policy has been. And as, people say, these forever wars, that's terrible. But that isn't the only way or the only outcome possible. Right? There are millions and millions of outcomes. So just because we were doing it a certain way and failing doesn't mean we should withdraw from the world and leave the rest of the world to whatever nefarious actors out there. Those aren't the only two solutions. Leading an intellectual revolution and encouraging Americans to realize a couple of things. First, that human beings around the world are more like us than they're different. Secondly, they want the same thing that we want. And thirdly, what we have to understand is the way that they can actually create those kinds of governments that represent their culture, but also our shared interest in freedom, individual freedom. Those are achievable and they exist. But sometimes what it requires is us to understand the people, listen and learn from them, and then figure out a way to help support building that governance within the context of their cultural behavior and their cultural history. And, I'll give you, I think, a really important example. And it goes back to, our project in Ukraine, which, as I said, I was there early in 1991. And, I've been back over the decades. And I think that more than probably your average American, I really understand a lot about the Ukrainian identity. And I believe that the Ukrainians are in many ways very much American in how they believe in freedom and sovereignty and, how they fought against the Soviet Union. And my father supported the Ruhr movement in Lvov against the Soviet Union. And that eventually led to a free Ukraine after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But they were basically constructed with a government that was built by the Soviet Union to act as, a government that basically watched the people and, controlled the people and controlled their behavior. And their main intelligence entity was created to spy on its own people, right? This was by design. And so when the Soviet Union collapsed, it wasn't like they got to fully restructure their government or, clean the slate and change, hundreds of years of cultural behavior that they adopted or was influenced on them by the Soviet Union. So an example is that in eastern Ukraine, you have this ethnic Russian population. Well, how did they get there? It's easy. Joseph Stalin physically by train moved ethnic Russians to Ukraine to occupy the farmland because it was the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. And so now, if you understand that history, you now understand why there's this internal friction between the ethnic Russians who are in Ukraine and the ethnic Ukrainians who are in Ukraine. But what's really important is that we understood that there was a lot of dysfunction, just like in our own country, in accountability within government. And we realized that we wanted to support the Ukrainians in being able to achieve their sovereignty and their freedom and defend themselves. But we didn't want to do it without there being actual accountability. We saw this in Afghanistan, 20 years of war, trillions of dollars wasted with no consequence, except we provided a much better government to the Taliban than the government that we toppled in early 2001 in a matter of months, right? And that was our own doing. So yes, we want to support freedom, but not at with no conditions. There should be conditions. There should be responsibility. So what our project was to find technological solutions to account for material support in Ukraine and then go to the Ukrainian government, which we did. And we actually got a letter from the commander of the Ukrainian Armed Forces Chief of Staff requesting this technology so that they could be accountable to the American people for the things that they're being given. And some of our biggest challenges is getting the US government to actually do this. because we're like, hey, the US government needs to be accountable to the American taxpayer for their money. This money doesn't belong to the politicians. It belongs to the American people. And they should be accountable to the American people for spending their money. And we want to see that. But we've had some success. We educated a lot of senators, congressmen, people in the military chain of command, all the way from on the ground to Ukraine to Special Operations Command year up. And everybody we talked to, almost without question, is like, this is a great idea. This is what we need to do. But getting the bureaucracy to do it is a challenge.
Right. Okay, so one thing you do with some of the donations you get at Freedom Research Foundation is hire these, a team to go into these conflict zones. Can you speak a little bit about who you're hiring and how they, they're skilled to be respectful and culturally sensitive and safe and all that?
Yeah, I think that from the special operations community, certainly you'll get out of the military as a whole, you'll get people who do have experience with indigenous populations and cultures and have traveled the world. And so we do look for people who have these experiences. Of course, not everybody, but you have to be comfortable realizing now that we do not represent the US government, right? We ideologically and philosophically represent the ideas we think of the American people and try to perpetrate them, but we don't represent the US government. So when we go into a place, we go in with zero authority. And so it's very important for us to understand that we're guests in that country. We have no authority. We're there to learn, to understand, to educate not only the people, but also fellow Americans back home. And so we're looking for a very unique type of person who is motivated by this work and usually comes from the special operations community. I think because a lot of them have seen the failures of these wars and know that we can do better and know that we're capable to do better.
Yes, they're very special people that you're actually like they've exited the military and now they've been trained, highly trained, from our military and our taxpayer dollars. So why not utilize them in a, a nonprofit sense or in a private sector sense with the skills that they've developed? That's fascinating that this could actually be a great spot, a great next step for them after they've exited special forces community. Okay, can you describe any partnerships or collaborations you have established with other organizations or academic institutions, or have you thought about doing this with your organization?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I wanted to say, and I think this is important because you said it, and it's certainly what we believe. The government is not going to solve the U.S. government, particularly. Let's just talk about that because there's lots of governments, but the U.S. government is really not going to solve these problems. It's the private sector that's going to solve these problems, and what the government should be doing is invigorating and encouraging the private sector in as many ways as possible to set conditions to go and solve these problems. And I think what's important about people transitioning out of the military is they are, they joined the military because they wanted a sense of purpose. And one thing that, Freedom Research does is give them that sense of purpose, but in a very different way, leveraging their skills. But I think that almost everywhere we go, we realize very quickly that the private sector is going to solve this problem, whether it's a technological solution to account for material support in Ukraine, or whether it's digital governance to make a government more efficient in northeastern Syria, or financial fintech solutions to, touch the international financial market. It is the private sector that's going to increase and expand freedom in a more efficient way, not governments. Now, of course, governments have to make some of the bigger decisions. That's the reality of the world we're in. But I do think that these people transitioning out have an opportunity to spend some time at Freedom Research, learn about these places, and then go into the private sector for-profit world and leverage that experience to go, make money. And there's nothing wrong with that because I think it's an important thing that we rethink how we conduct American foreign policy and that we don't have to always spend just American money to solve these problems. There are people there willing to do business, to make money, to pay for their own governments and their own militaries. And we should leverage the American economy and the ingenuity and the complexity of our economy to help them achieve that so they can pay for their own government and their own military and their own wars. We don't have to spend American taxpayer dollars all the time to do this. And in fact, we've proven more times than not that it doesn't actually work. As far as partnerships, I mentioned, most of our partnerships are really informal. But I mentioned the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom. We were reached out to by the Special Operations Task Force in Syria, and we provided lots of briefs and into cultural context. And they were in a kind of unique political situation, and we helped them achieve things that they admittedly said they couldn't have done on their own without us. Of course, we brief a lot of different institutions, but we're always looking for people, organizations who, have a common goal, common objective that we can work with.
So I guess another what I was kind of curious about is if you guys do this research and you put together your findings and whatnot, how do you disseminate this information? Like, is there a group to how do you get the information out to the broader public? If you have all these projects across around the world, what's your vision for how this information's going to be put out there? It was like you said in the beginning of our talk, there's a lot of now we have an excess of information. Before we didn't have a lot, and maybe in the 70s or 80s, now we have too much information. So what's your vision for after you've done this research, how do you get it out to the broader public?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I think in modern day, we could probably do a better job of synthesizing some of the information we do for general consumption, right? Your average American does not want to read, an 80-page research report on informal, formal, and illicit governance in northeastern Syria, and then how to create an interagency joint task force to solve the problem and create a, pro-American principled governance of 4.5 million people. Like, most people aren't going to read that. But doing that work allows the people who wake up every single day, whose responsibility is to solve that problem, whether it is the State Department or the Defense Department or wherever, to look at it from a different perspective. It also helps us think about how I always describe us as a do tank, not a think tank, right? So to give you another example of something we did is we spent 3 years advocating in the best interests of, American freedom and free market economy to get a OFAC license for the people of northeastern Syria so that foreign companies could come in there and do business. Once again, because it goes back to, an important salient point about what we do is that we don't think that we should always spend American money to try to solve the world's problems. There are people there who are willing to make money and spend that money to make a better lives for themselves. And that is a much better way to do it. So I think as far as synthesizing the information and being able to, explain it in general consumption, conduits like this, podcasts like yours or whatever are good ways to do that. We could probably do better. I go to a lot of different places in the country, in the United States, and I'm asked to give a talk or a briefing about what's happening in this place or that place. And some of our other staff do the same thing. But we are very focused, right? So we're looking at these projects, and then we're thinking, who can we engage to try to make this project or the results of this research effective in influencing American policy. And that is important to engage the general public, but also sometimes we engage people in government who are decision makers.
So okay, one thing that it's been really amazing talking to you over this past hour. And one thing I want to point out that you mentioned is that I think what Freedom Research Foundation is doing that's really great is you're hiring former special operation military personnel, which is amazing. They're so highly skilled. So this is giving them once they exit the military, they can still use their skills. You mentioned something else where. If they could still use their skills if they like came in to work for a nonprofit or a think tank or a do tank, like you said, like this, which is amazing. The second thing is you kind of mentioned that I was like, oh, I didn't think about this from the private sector is that with foreign policy now and the world changing and us having these conflicts across the world, that this actually does affect American business and the Americans' ability to do business in certain countries. And it is, foreign policy should be, a major concern, not only for the safety of us as Americans, but also our ability to, potentially do business, which a lot of Americans
that's a freedom that they, hold dear. And we think we can, we're supposed to be able to pursue happiness and growth and our own interests. So I used to, you mentioned that. And then, and education, that's like the three biggest takeaways I took away from this. So this organization, in order to actually function, has to have people that, want to give to it and support these projects. And I just want to say, like, to people listening, if they want to do that, they can donate online or reach out. But I also want to see, like, based on what you said, like, overall, like, with the way the world is going, what do you think the biggest impact is going to be over time with this organization?
Look, I think that we're providing a alternative way of thinking about how we solve problems as Americans around the world. And that is, you don't need more people, more bureaucracy, more money. What you need is a better understanding the private sector, and you need to leverage the private sector to find real world problems, or real world ways to solve problems. And we're proving that with, a very small budget and just, adhering to the idea that we're going to spend 10, 20 times more effort trying to understand a place and the complexities of it before we decide what we're going to do. And
Right.
I think that we really are very interested in continuing to find companies in the private sector who want to try to solve these problems, just for the purposes of, expanding their financial returns around the world. Because I fundamentally believe that having an American company anywhere will have a larger impact on the behavior of that population in a positive way than allowing China, Russia, Iran to come in and provide an alternative. And people in Africa and the Middle East are learning this the hard way. And so we want to encourage people to say, look, Americans can go to remote, difficult parts of the world. They can make money, and they can also help us defend our way of life and, support freedom.
That was so well said. I wish we had more time because this topic is so interesting, and I know you have so much more knowledge about all everything going on. So we should do this again. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't say it any better than you just did. So this has been really, really fascinating, and thank you for being here.
Well, Megan, first, thank you so much for having me, and also to all your listeners. I really encourage them to challenge the status quo. And I think that, one of the things we have to remind ourselves is that we've got to understand that real education is about how to think, not what to think. And if you have that ability, then you can always navigate yourself through the world and come to, a good solid grounding of what you believe.
Absolutely. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing to the Business Talk podcast and leaving us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us grow and improve. Thank you for joining us today. This has been another episode of Business Talk with Megan McNulty.